Welcome to Offline, a podcast about building a 100% online and remote expertise-driven business without the bullshit. Hosted remotely by me, Liston Witherell.
And me, Philip Morgan. You'll learn how we're building our businesses, what scares the shit out of us, and hear from our friends and experts who are building their remote businesses too. Welcome to Offline.
Philip Morgan.
Liston Witherell.
Offline. Welcome once again, my friend.
Thank you.
Is my food ready? What did I order? It's been a while. I don't even remember.
Folks at home can't see this, but I got this little bell that has a big smiley face on it. It makes me happy to look at it and makes me happy to ring it. I promise I won't ring it, hopefully at all, during this episode.
When you win a new client, do you ring the bell for yourself?
No, but, well, I haven't thus far, but you bet I will now.
That's a hell of an idea, my friend.
You know, I'm just so used to winning clients. Like, I'm sick of winning at this point, Liston. So, Yeah, that's why I forgot to ring it.
What is the song? All I do is win, 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 no matter what.
I haven't heard that one.
I think it's DJ Khaled.
Okay. So I heard, what's the guy's name that we were talking about? He's amazing.
Leon Bridges.
Yeah, Leon Bridges. I've been listening to a lot of Leon Bridges lately. So I'm playing him for my wife, who's never heard him. And she's like, oh, that's pretty cool. And then Pony comes on, which is a cover. And she's like,
the cover of the Genuine song?
Yeah, the cover of the Genuine song, Pony. So she has this huge flashback to like the 80s when she was growing up, listening to stuff like that. So now I've been playing the Genuine version of Pony.
That was the 90s. I believe I was a freshman in high school when that song came out. My guess would be 1995.
Yeah. But Liston, really, I've been trying to heal my relationship with neo-soul music. So that's where all this is coming from.
Did you get to the song River by Leon Bridges?
Oh, so good.
Yes.
So good.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of his songs are so good.
I love the new album. Very different direction this time, but yeah.
Guy's the real deal.
Indeed. Fort Worth, Texas. So today, Philip, we are going to talk about, I don't know, is this esoteric? I don't know if it is exactly, but it's certainly a real concern or a consideration, let's say, that we've both had, which is how do you balance the need to build a viable, serious, expertise-driven brand while also knowing that direct response and psychology play a role in getting people to act and buy stuff to not only help you develop your business, but to be exposed to more people that you can help, which is definitely my goal. And I think it's yours too.
Yeah.
And it can, as you say, create trust issues, and it has a certain quote smell to it.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by that?
And an odor. It's not esoteric, but it is hard to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes it feel like esoteric, that it's sort of difficult to put into words. And you and I have been dancing around this episode for about a month now, I think, since I first brought that. Really, you brought this up in a conversation you and I were having offline from offline. And it just like was the right time. It really stuck with me. And I've been trying to develop my thoughts about it. I've made some progress, but I feel like this is a callback to the old offline where we just are spitballing the whole time. It's going to be a little bit like that, folks, because my thoughts on it are not fully crystallized, but it's such an important issue, I think, especially in light of the kind of business that Liston and I are both trying to build, which is an expertise-driven business.
Exactly. So that's, I talked to David C. Baker recently and had him on the podcast, and I was asking him about this because, as is typical, you know, he says, basically, if people don't either love or hate what you're writing and putting out into the world, you're not doing your job. Basically, like, choose a fucking position, right? Which I think, after talking to him, I realized generally leads to an oversimplification or lack of nuance in the discussion, which is great for the internet. The internet likes lack of nuance. They like declarations.
Yeah.
However, when it comes to actually applying this to your business, it seemed a little bit murky to me. So one thing he says in The Business of Authority is, you should really not be too available to your clients on your website. So I think one of the things he cited was instant chat. So you shouldn't, if you have one of those little bubbles that's like, how can I help you today? And you're available in that moment, that could look bad for you because it could bring into question your expertise because in a way it's negative social proof. You're not so busy that you can actually be here right now to chat with me.
Right.
Well, on the flip side of that, and that's a pretty obvious and straightforward use case, but on the flip side of that, I think if you make it too difficult to get a hold of you, you start to look really aloof, and I start to feel as though the goal of our marketing, which is to have more conversations, to reach people, show them our expertise, and start to spark more conversations, may not come to fruition because we just seem like too cool for school. And so I think this is part of where this question is. It's like, well, where's the line? How can I be available enough to still seem like an expert, but not so available that my expertise is questioned?
Yeah.
Maybe one thing we can do is contrast brand versus direct response marketing.
You're talking about balancing two things, availability versus the things that signal being in demand, like one of which would be, well, it's not that easy to get to you, or you have to go through a gatekeeper, or there's some kind of line or queue that you have to make your way through, or a waiting list, or like all those things signal limited availability, or they signal the demand is greater than the supply. And that's a nice sort of segue into what we're going to talk about is brand versus direct response marketing. So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe we should come back to the authenticity of signals, because I think you can run into the same problems with brand marketing that you run into with direct response marketing. But to contrast the two, probably the most obvious and well-known example of direct response marketing is infomercials. You see a commercial, they try to talk you into buying a ShamWow, and within 58 seconds, you're dialing a phone number in order to get 3 free ShamWows for the price of one.
Can we dig into that deeper?
Yeah.
There's other things going on too. There's demonstration usually. Most memorable example from my childhood might be the Ginsu knives commercial, where they had this knife that was sawing through all kinds of things where you're like, holy crap, they just sawed through a tree branch with that, or 6 soda cans or whatever. That's another thing you see a lot, demonstration, social proof. The infomercials that you see on TV are a sort of cartoon-fied, jacked-up version of direct response marketing, but they show a lot of elements of what's typical. Length is another one. Like, do you think you could spend an hour selling a pair of knives, set of knives? Yes, you can, it turns out.
Oh, you could spend more than that. I mean, yeah, for sure. I remember when I was a kid, the Blue Blockers commercials, which were just a really cheap, probably cost them under 20 cents to produce a pair of these sunglasses.
Yeah.
And they would sell the benefits of the lenses and how the lenses were polarized, which of course, any decent pair of sunglasses has polarized lenses.
Yeah.
But the magic was from Joe Sugarman, was the copywriter on that project, and that, yeah, that led to selling more of them. So they demonstrated the product, they had third-party objective reviews, so reviews and testimonials that go on your website. This is a key element of direct response. They always have authority. So in ShamWow, they would say, designed by German engineers. So that brings in the authority piece.
Yep.
So maybe, I don't remember what it was for Blue Blockers, or maybe Ginsu knives. Yeah, they're like, oh, they're made by Japanese craftsmen or something like that.
Yeah, they're sort of evoking, they're tapping into, I mean, this is another common characteristic of direct response, is trying to tap into something emotional. And I'm sure you could give a whole hour-long lecture on how, like, that's legit, because emotions drive a lot of really good decisions.
Well, all decisions, whether they're good or bad, are typically emotionally driven.
Right. So a subset of them are going to be good. That's why I said it that way. It's not like emotional decision-making, bad, danger. It's just that's how decisions are made. But you see that particularly amplified in direct response marketing. And there's usually a real, I want to say exaggeration, but there's just like a heat-seeking missile that's going for the, whatever the pain is or whatever the problem is.
And when we think about how this would be applied to a consulting or expertise-driven business, like one common example I would think of is someone puts a free training on their website and then you click it and it says like only X number of seats available, hurry up and claim your spot. Something like that would be like a clear direct response kind of tactic and smell of direct response. Okay, so why is this good or why is this bad? And I'm going to contrast brand marketing in a second.
Can I give my fun definition of direct response?
Yeah, you may, please.
Direct response is a form or a button with a plan or a funnel behind it.
Right. So that's what I was going to say. Yeah. So,
oh, sorry. I didn't mean to steal your
time. No, it's fine. So in this webinar, you know, get your free training and then you go on and it's a webinar and you're not really getting the information that was promised, which is deeply frustrating, and that's intentional. And then they say, by the way, if you want to solve this problem, sign up for this thing, and you don't sign up for it. And then you get 8 emails over the next 2 weeks telling you why you should sign up for the thing. That would be like a classic direct response thing. Now, why is that bad? It's not necessarily. In the short run, it's probably the fastest way to get more sales because you're giving people more opportunities to respond to the question, do you want to buy something from me? Whether they say yes or no, you're just giving them more opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. What it's not going to do probably for a lot of people is position you as an expert who belongs on a TED stage. And so there's, I think part of this discussion is about what category are you in the buyer's mind? Are you in the sort of TED New York Times bestseller category? Or are you in the, he's an internet guy doing internet things, but it was really helpful.
Right. It's sort of like the company you keep.
Yeah.
We kind of keep dancing around this idea that direct response marketing has an odor or a smell. And I like that because you don't really, if it's an odor emanating from a person, you have to be pretty close to them to smell it, unless it's just horrible. And it's sort of, some things like pheromones and stuff like that kind of operate on this almost like below the conscious level of activity and signaling. And I feel like that's an appropriate metaphor because what we're talking about can be kind of subtle. But when you start using these tools, let's just call them tools of direct response, like I do think of it as a sort of toolkit. And to me, the tools are neutral. But guess who else tends to use those tools? Really sleazy people doing really sleazy shit.
Maybe this is sort of like a Marshall McLuhan, the message is the medium type thing, right? Or as Seth Godin says, people like us do things like this, right?
Yeah.
So essentially, people will put you in a category that maybe you don't want to be in if you're trying to build a reputable, authoritative, expertise-driven brand. It doesn't fall in line with the sort of direct response, massive amounts of emails that are seemingly begging for a sale. It's just not the same. Those types of people wouldn't do that. In other words.
Right. Yeah. I think we slightly glossed over something I wanted to say, which is
certainly
direct response is, again, it's a tool set, it's neutral, and it's a godsend for small businesses.
Right. Here's the rub.
Yeah, right. And I'm purposefully contrasting this against what you just said, Liston, not because I disagree with what you just said at all. I think we're very much on the same page here. We're seeing the same conflict, but there's this toolkit called direct response that's like a godsend. So imagine being in the 50s and the internet doesn't exist and you want to start a consulting company. What are you going to do? Well, there's a version of direct response that existed before the internet, which was direct mail generally, or maybe telemarketing.
Also, door-to-door, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Go knock on some doors. Find the biggest office park near your work and just
hit,
start pushing buttons.
That's right.
Yep.
Smiling and dialing, hitting the bricks, all that. So just set aside that that existed and imagine that that didn't exist. And the internet didn't exist. Like, how are you going to get your early customers? You're going to be limited to referrals and word of mouth and like people who know of you and know of your new venture, or you're going to be limited to advertising, right? And you're going to be thinking, well, I can take out an ad in the, I guess in the classifieds, that would be the lowest cost, all the way up to like a full page ad or a 2-page spread in some print publication. And I'm painting a very simplified model of what the reality was back then. But what is that ad going to cost? Multiple thousands of dollars, multiple tens of thousands of dollars if it's a bigger publication. And that would have just been out of reach for someone trying to bootstrap a small boutique consultancy. I don't love that word, but anyway. Fast forward to where the internet has taken us, and now there's like dozens of free except for your time and the associated potential negative impact on your reputation. There's dozens of free ways to reach people using direct response means. And so when I say it's been a godsend for businesses like ours, that's what I mean.
Yeah. So just to contrast that with brand marketing. So brand marketing is almost like a derogatory term that modern marketers use. The reason that it's derogatory to a lot of marketers is because it's really hard to measure the effects of it.
Right.
So perfect example, actually Google is a great example, right? So Google had a Super Bowl ad and the majority of the ad was spent talking about helping veterans get jobs and like what the job search might look like for a veteran. And at the very end of it, they type in a search phrase into a Google search box. What is the dollar impact of that 2 million or 4 million, I don't know how much a Super Bowl ad is anymore, but what is the impact of that on the brand of Google? Now, it's impossible to say.
Yeah.
They could probably trace, okay, what is the 24 or 48 hour bump in search volume? But they already have 90% market share or whatever it is today, 85%. So that's not why they did it. Why did they do it? Because they want to associate their brand and deepen the connection of the brand to particular values. Google is a thoughtful company that helps veterans, and we care about people and some of the most disadvantaged people who need the most help. That's why they did it.
Yeah.
And so brand marketing has this kind of values-driven, warm glow aura kind of perception to it, where very similar to the Al Reese positioning, a word in the mind. We're trying to connect our business name and our overall brand to either a value or a thing that people will associate us with.
Yeah. I think of brand, my simplified but fun definition is brand marketing is art with a logo on it, which matches up really well with what you're talking about.
Okay. Let me challenge you on that. Can I challenge you on that?
Yeah.
So let's go back to the Super Bowl, right?
But let me put a pin in this. We need to differentiate between B2C versus B2B. Anyway, go back to the Super Bowl thing.
Okay, I'll give you an example of brand marketing and B2B.
It's those airport signs, right? Is that what you were going to say?
I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say Salesforce Dreamforce.
Okay, good.
100,000 plus person conference. Yeah. And the key reason, I haven't interviewed the CMO at Salesforce or the person who conceived of this, but my guess is the key reason they do it is they want to position Salesforce as being at the center, the sort of brains of the sales operation and the brains of a company's contact relationship marketing program.
Yeah.
That's why they do it, is to bring developers there, other vendors, companies who use Salesforce. We're the center of the universe. But are they expecting that event itself to generate more Salesforce users? Not exactly. That's not exactly the purpose.
Yeah. I don't know if you were pushing back on my example or not, because I don't see that didn't feel like strong pushback. Because another way I think of it that might align with what you're talking about is Salesforce is sort of in there as a sort of cultural institution, might be a way to think about Dreamforce. Like, it's kind of become that, I think. I think some people think about their year and they think about, what is it, a week at Dreamforce, something like that, 3-4 days. They think about that and like that's now part of their life. And that's in a way what brand marketing does, is it kind of gets into your life because it becomes part of the culture that you live within.
Mm-hmm. The example I was going to give you that sort of, I think maybe starts to demonstrate the fusion, and I'm only using B2C examples because most people are familiar with them, or at least more people are. So yeah. I think about the Lexus commercials.
Okay.
Especially the end of year ones. So you come home and you call your spouse out and he or she comes out and there's a big bow on a brand new Lexus in front of like this really fancy house in a posh neighborhood.
Right.
And now that's art with a logo on it.
Yeah.
But it also has the elements of saying, so the sort of value or brand that they're trying to push is people with discerning tastes who have money love Lexus.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it has a bow on it. It's snowing outside, which is pushing on the urgency, end of year, buy your spouse a gift. There are elements of direct response in there.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they air those commercials in November and December and not for the rest of the year.
Yeah, there is a lot of brand marketing that it would essentially be timeless. I mean, we're not totally timeless, but within a given five-year period, it would be relevant, right?
Right.
I don't watch a lot of TV, so I don't have great examples just at the ready. That's one where it's making use, exactly like you said, of, we could call it a problem. I had a really good year, and I need to show my family that. Like, it's addressing a specific sort of time-bound need. And that would be something that's straight out of the direct response playbook for sure.
Yeah. And I think the need is they need more cars to leave the lot as soon as possible.
I was talking about in the customer's mind.
No, because, I know.
Yeah. I know.
But that's the other think that's side the real need.
That gets to the signaling.
Yeah.
Which is, I was wrestling with this whole thing for, I just looked at the timestamp on my first note on this, and it was almost exactly 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a sort of breakthrough about a week ago, and I realized that it's about signals, and neediness is a big part of the difference between these two, let's just call them tool sets or toolkits.
Well, I wanted to touch on one more thing before we try to bring this home and make it like super relevant to everybody listening.
Yeah.
Because so far it's been like a marketing theory class.
Let's keep it irrelevant as long as possible.
Yeah. That's our goal every time, isn't it? So last night I was driving home from Washington. I was at a friend's, he had a family gathering, sort of a last minute thing due to a loss in his family. And we decided to go up to Seattle in order to attend the event.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that there was a chance we would get snowed in on the way home. So we went to the event, we got in our car, started to come back, and the snow was absolutely unsafe within like an hour. And so I pulled off the road and I'm thinking, okay, we're stuck here. Here's our problem. We're stuck. We have nowhere to stay. The snow is awful. Like, I can't go searching for the best hotel in the area. This is a typical direct response problem.
Right.
Need a hotel room? We've got rooms.
Yeah. Like, right.
That's sort of the direct response version. Whereas the brand market version would be, hey, is there a Marriott around here?
Right.
Right. I'm looking for a specific thing. Even if just when I'm on vacations, I always go to Marriott's because I get the best experience, or I always go to whatever it is. I think that illustrates the problem well. I think direct response tends to focus much more on the problem and the urgency, and brand tends to focus much more on, I'd say more on the positive rather than the loss factors.
Yeah.
Typically focused a little bit more on the positive and the values you would associate with the brand.
I think that's totally fair. It's interesting in that example to observe that the direct response marketing could have gone from zero to effective in the day before you got stranded in the snowstorm.
Yeah.
So someone could have, just to make this specific, weirdly specific, if someone could have set up a Google AdWords campaign. When was this? What day was this? Was yesterday. So
Sunday.
So Saturday. Someone could have set up a Google AdWords campaign for whatever little podunk town you were in when you got stranded. And said, I really want to capture search traffic for best nice hotel in whatever Washington.
Lacey Washington.
Lacey Washington. There we go. And that one day lead time could have led to them getting your $120 for that hotel room or whatever it was. If we look at the brand marketing, that's not enough time. Best Western, to use your example, would have needed 5 to 10 years to establish that sort of mental residue in Liston's mind that might have caused Liston to say, I don't just want any hotel. I want to stay in a Best Western because I always get it right. Yep. They always, you know, I know how the place is laid out. It's comfortable. Their advertising is funny and memorable, or they really have set their business up to serve people like me, calling back to Seth Godin's People Like Us Do Things Like This meme. So they would have needed years to establish that reputation in your mind. And that's, it's really interesting to me to look at that aspect. And that's why I say for new businesses, direct response is a godsend, because most new businesses don't have, businesses like ours, don't have the advertising budget to spend their way into the minds of a critical mass of people. And we don't have the time to do it either, even if we had the money to do it.
Well, I think also a significant challenge is, let's stay on this hotel's example so we can beat it to death.
Great.
Let's say I go on a 5 to 10 year endeavor of building my brand, whatever it is. So like Motel 6, we always leave the lights on, right?
Yeah.
Do you want clean sheets and a floor that's not too dirty for really cheap? We got you, right? Like that's their brand.
Sure.
And the Ritz-Carlton is like, we have the absolute best properties in the best locations.
Yeah.
And you're going to pay really top dollar for that.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those brands, if you go to those websites, right? They're not going to easily let you leave without booking. So even though they're both embarking on a brand marketing, and one, Motel 6 is much more sort of direct response-y, and there's nothing at stake for the high end. They don't have a high end luxury perception.
Mm-hmm.
But even the Ritz in the top corner of the website says reserve now, and there's calls to action peppered all through the site. So this is where I think what you just said, we work really hard on limited resources in order to expose ourselves to a niche market,
right?
And niche just meaning like a subset of a subset,
yeah.
Right? So like below a million for sure, probably in the tens or hundreds of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
We've done incredibly hard work to get someone to our website. Now, in order to preserve this perception of being high end, we're supposed to not use any direct response tactics and just sort of let them leave. Like, so that's really what's difficult, is how much is okay to capture an email address or to put a call offer in front of them or whatever it is, tease them with lead magnets.
Yeah.
Like, how much can I do knowing that I worked really hard and it was through an authentic drive to give them free, valuable stuff? I don't want them to just leave, right? If I can help them more, I want them to know that I can. And for me, this is what's really, really exceedingly difficult about answering this question of where do we fall in that spectrum in order to maintain our high-end brand aura? I don't know what the right word is. Perception? I guess perception is the right word. How do we maintain our high-end brand perception and not have the stink of direct response while using enough direct response in order to be able to help those people that we can? That is the rub for me. I just don't have a great answer for it.
I'll just disappoint all of our listeners by saying there is no one answer for this.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're trying to present both. Again, it's not like both perspectives. It's just like, I think we're just trying to walk our way through this really interesting sort of tension that exists between these two styles or these two toolkits. Because, well, I mean, one way to resolve that tension is to say, I am going to start out at a place that's different where I want to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be the same blend or mix of these styles, these tools. I'm going to start out, and I'm saying this because I think this is the approach I either consciously or semi-unconsciously chose. The approach is, I'm going to start out direct response heavy, and then I'm going to kind of slide the weight on the scale. That's a terrible analogy. Anyway, I'm going to sort of slide things over to the brand marketing as I can afford to.
Yeah.
I'm looking at Accenture's website right now to try to see what the smell is like.
I was actually going to ask you about timing. Where you are in your brand progress, I think, is a big question here. I think you're almost going to be forced to, if you rely on the internet or other forms of direct response, you're going to have to include more direct response than you would once you have a brand and you have awareness. And let's be honest, this all comes down to lead flow. If you can pull all forms off of your website and still have 50 emails a week begging you to take their money, then you don't have to answer this question at all. You're just like, oh, I'm a brand now.
Yeah. And that's probably what you should do, because that's the most aligned with what I think we want, which is to send the signal and to have that signal be true. Mm-hmm. And the signal is, this expertise is well known enough and valuable enough and proven enough that people are beating down my door to get access to it. That's, I think, where we all want to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're starting out, it's not embarrassing that you're signaling that that's not true. You're signaling that the expertise is new, or it's unknown, or it's unproven. And so what you're doing is you're using this direct response toolkit to compensate for that fact, right? And then as you can start to drop elements of it, you do. I guess I have a real world example, and this is probably a big part of why this is on my mind. I'm in the middle of rewriting the positioning manual and creating the third version of that book. I am shockingly close to $100,000 in lifetime direct revenue from that book, which is amazing. Like, that's, and probably in some upper echelon of authors, actually. Now, certainly, when you look at the follow-on revenue that comes from consulting or other opportunities, then I am not in some upper echelon. And I think you, Alan Weiss rightly argues that that's the needle you're trying to move, not book sales. The book is an intermediate thing that's trying to move another needle, which is selling profitable consulting services.
Yeah, Alan would say it's just a lead magnet. Don't worry about the sales.
Yeah, and he's right. But again, I'm very sensitive to the fact that the people you and I are talking to are probably a lot like us in that they're real bootstrappers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to make trade-offs to make the whole thing work. One of two examples: we're not like funded with investor money, or we're not like parachuting out of some corporate job with a bunch of connections into consulting. And I think that's what a lot of Alan's target market is doing, is like they hit their 50s and they were senior VP at some place and now they're transitioning into consulting. And
at Verizon, and now they're like trotting the globe doing telecom or VoIP consulting or something like that.
Yeah, which is great. Nothing negative about that, except that doesn't look at all like where I started. I came in through the side door, and you did too, I think.
Right. Yep.
So when you're coming in through the side door, you got to look for every advantage you can. And so back to the positioning manual, every advantage for me with that looked like selling it like a typical info product with three pricing tiers, quite expensive. For a business book, the genre of business book is going to be between 40 and 80,000 words, and it's going to cost between, I don't know, say $10 and $30. That defines the genre of business book. And it's not going to be sold on some website with a long form sales letter. That, however, is exactly what I did. Long form sales letter, three price tiers. For some dude who just like came out of nowhere, and about 3 years, I guess. January 2015 is when I sold the first copy of that book. So we're now at 4 years. Yeah, $25,000 a year, roughly, in book sales. That's nothing to sneeze at.
Mm-hmm.
But as I see where I want to take my business, I feel like that's the sales page for that book, and the pricing structure and the fact that it's self-published all exude a certain odor. And it sure looks a lot like some really sleazy stuff, doesn't it? When you just look at it as at the sort of structural elements of how I'm selling and packaging that book.
Well, I think it can to some people. And so
sure.
I don't want to treat any market as a monolith, because it's not. It's
exactly
a bunch of individuals, right, who are making their own determinations. And like anybody who's read your book or read your emails knows, A, Philip is totally legit and actually wants to help people, and B, there's something here, right? It's not, I think, underpinning the negative feelings about direct response or maybe the cheapness or cheesiness that can come from people experiencing it is when they were oversold or overpromised and then they got the product and they were like, oh, I get it. This isn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. And that's where direct response gets a bad name. So yes.
And I think if it's a random sampling, no one needs to buy more than about 5 such products. Ebooks that someone's selling online, courses that someone is selling online. I think you buy 5 of them and you're going to have at least one experience like you're talking about that leaves a really bad taste.
At least one. I agree with that.
Yeah. Maybe more.
In my experience, it's been more.
So it's like you don't have to have that many data points to get that impression. And again, I want to stop here and say, this is not me beating up on direct response. It's just been an absolutely vital part of me getting my business to where it is today. But I feel like I can now afford to let go of some elements of it as I move closer to something that looks like brand marketing.
Yep.
And it's not that I'm buying a Super Bowl ad next year. That's not what I mean. But there's a certain wastefulness or lack of efficiency in brand marketing. And that sends a different signal. To me, that sends a signal of, oh, wow, this person is doing really well and can afford for everything to not be optimized to the penny.
Yeah, and in some ways, it's just sort of a lengthier marketing process because what you're really trying to do is create a feeling, essentially, within your market or an affinity that they have towards you.
And I would say to extend the footprint of that feeling, I would add on to what you said, yeah, to kind of reach some sort of critical mass is maybe not the right word, but to spread that feeling more broadly.
Right. And I think direct response would take an approach like, we'll continue to use you as an example. I'd be happy to share mine. But for you, it might be Philip appears on a podcast. Philip suggests go sign up for this email list. Once you do that, you're getting this book offer. So it's almost like awareness, offer, response.
Yeah.
It's a pretty clear line. Whereas brand marketing looks a lot more like zigzags and swirlies where you're sort of like, exposure, white paper, join a webinar, like do all this kind of stuff and maybe read our CEO's book and maybe for an individual, I think maybe one of the problems I've had personally, and I'll readily admit this, is maybe I'm doing too much stuff that looks like brand marketing and not enough direct response.
Oh, interesting. What do you mean?
So for instance, right, I'll go on these podcasts, and I haven't been a big fan of like pointing people to an individual lead magnet.
Okay.
And so I just sort of say, go to liston.io. And like, if you see something there, sign up or don't ever come back. It's totally cool. Right.
Yeah.
And some people do, and some people don't. I think what I see as being more successful for a lot of people is to say, go sign up for this particular thing that's tied directly to what I talked about, and you'll get 4 emails, and then I'm selling them something.
Well, that's exactly what I've done with the positioning manual.
Right. I know, my friend.
So it's nice that we're representing not polar opposite ends of this spectrum, but still at a different place. Because it's a good illustration for the folks listening who might have seen what we're doing.
Totally. Yeah. And so like right now on my homepage, it links to my services, which I think a good true direct response approach would be to give some sort of offer that I think that I want particular people who hit that website to see and sign up for, and then automatically put them into something that sells them something or gives them a chance to, let's say, give over a meatier piece of information like their phone number. And then I implicitly have permission to call them. That kind of thing would be a little bit more direct response, which I'm not doing.
Yeah. I'm looking at Accenture's homepage and my website's homepage.
Can you just in case they don't know, what is Accenture?
Oh, big consulting company, does a fair bit of strategy type work, somewhat tech heavy. Well, one of the big 4 consulting companies. I don't see, the only thing that looks like a form on their homepage is a subscribe button for their newsletter,
mm-hmm.
which technically takes you to another place where you can subscribe to one of 2-3 dozen different newsletters, right? My homepage has at least 2 opt-in forms on it.
But it's a little bit different because of how large their business is. So they want you to either click on insights or businesses. Those are the first 2 things in their navigation. And if I click on technology consulting, let's see what comes up on that page. Because these are essentially all home pages for each of their services, which represents like 5,000 employees each or something. Why Accenture? Yeah, they're all think pieces.
Yeah.
And then their call to action is work for us. So I guess they think they're more likely to get potential employees on this website than clients.
Sure. But it's a nice illustration, a little oversimplified, I know, but of direct response versus brand marketing.
Yep. So, yeah, I think there's where I'm landing on this personally is I think I'm going to turn up the direct response, which probably sounds like the opposite conclusion most people thought I would come to based on the way we started this discussion. But when I think about the life cycle of my business, that's probably where I need to be today. I also feel wholly authentic about my intentions for using it, right? Like, I'm not trying to get over on anybody. I'm not trying to create. So one thing we didn't touch on here is fake urgency. And I think that's one of the things that creates the stink, but also it's, in my opinion, not ethical.
Yeah.
So while it may be legitimate to say you only have X number of seats technically available on your webinar, like with you're on Zoom, right, Philip?
Yeah.
So the base plan gives you 100 webinar seats. The next plan up gives you 500. So if I had the 500 one, I might say, well, only 500 seats. Get your seat now. It's sort of implying that like they're going fast and you better do it now. And so if that's not true, that feels to me like quite deceptive.
Yeah. Let's drill into this a little bit because this is where I see some of the more, like once you know what you're looking for, it's just so obvious when you see someone pulling shit like this.
Yep.
And it might be nice to kind of like list out, like personally, at least for you, Liston, what are the most offensive elements of direct response marketing? Like, what are the ones you see? Again, they're tools, they're neutral, it's how they're used. Which are the ones that you see abused in the worst fashion?
So one that I see abused all the time that I haven't talked about already is gray area, I'd say like gray hat social proof.
Okay.
So you and I know a lot of people who know each other in the internet marketing game in some way or another, not to say like we're Perry Marshall, but people who build their businesses online. And I think what you'll find is a lot of folks have other people they know giving them testimonials who probably never bought their services.
Right. Right.
And I'm not going to name any names, and you maybe even know some people I might be referring to right now, but that's a common one. And that sort of gives the impression to the person on the page that this person who I'm thinking about investing money and time with has all these people who've had all these great experiences, but some of them are friends, right? And the truth is, I was actually chatting with one of your, I guess, students, TEI students. Bob and I had an exchange today, and I referred him to this movie called The Yes Men, which is a wonderful movie, where they pose as experts in various fields. And what they were trying to do was expose how easy it is to seem like you have authority when actually you have none, and all you do is say absurd shit.
Uh-huh.
So like they do this bit where they go to, I think it's like Harvard Business School, and they give this whole presentation on the reuse of food. And so they're like, we're going to pitch this. We have this revolutionary idea for McDonald's. And basically they bring this video and it's like someone eating a cheeseburger and then they shit it out. And like it, the shit turns into a burger patty that they then sell to third world markets.
God,
that was the one time in the show where the students sort of revolted and they're like, this is disgusting. Like you can't do this. But they got into all of these places, and because there's no arbiter of truth on the internet, bad third-party testimonials, maybe not bad, but let's say arguably black hat or gray hat mm-hmm. testimonials are one thing that I see all the time and just sort of stinks. And like having 100 testimonials on your site to me feels like, wow, they're trying really hard.
Yeah. Let me jump in with what I hope is a funny story. So a number of years ago, I became a part of a mastermind, the Productized Consulting Roundtable. And we sort of did that unintentionally. Like the group had this really great sort of energy and it gelled really well. And so we all just kind of started giving testimonials for everybody else's shit, whatever that was, book or services. And this is the funny part to me. Someone like started noticing that. They actually mapped it out and published a blog post about how it seemed really fishy to them.
And it is.
It is. Yeah. From their perspective, I can 100% see that. It's just being in it and having a front row seat to it, I can tell you it was never any grand plan for us. It was just like, well, you know, we were friends and we had this sort of group energy that just led to doing that.
Right.
But from the outside, it looked fishy as hell.
Right.
So we've got on your list of things that are offensive, certain usages of social proof. What else?
So desperation or neediness, I think, is kind of the stink of all of it.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this comes down to fake urgency.
On the desperation, like that's one of the things I had noted as well. And I just wanted to say that maybe I'm too close to it, to my own marketing.
I wonder that too. I wonder, are we two nerds having this conversation that most customers don't give a shit about? Or if they knew about it, would it be a problem? But since they don't, it's not anyway. So we're making something out of nothing. I don't know.
I think that's entirely possible. I mean, what I choose to believe is, well, we care. And so we're talking about this because we care. But it is possible, alternately, that we're just too close to it. But let's see, what am I trying to say?
You're going to talk about fake urgency.
Well, I was going to talk about neediness. Like, that's where I started to first feel like my usage of direct response tools was giving off a little bit of a funky odor. Mm-hmm. It was like, I tried to think, okay, I'm a really sort of jaded, cynical buyer of my own services. And I'm looking at my website or my marketing, and I'm just wondering, why is this Philip guy working so hard to get an email address out of me? Why is he working so hard to convince me that I have a problem that could be somewhat miraculous if solved? Why is he trying so hard? Is this guy needy? Is he desperate? Does he not have enough work? Is the value of his expertise not self-evident? Is he trying to sort of pump up something that's a little bit thin or insubstantial? And again, I might just be way into my head too much for my own good as I'm thinking these thoughts, but that's the thing I wanted to call out before we move on to fake urgency about sort of the seed of my original dissatisfaction with direct response.
Well, I'll give you an example of this, which I'm not really sure what it illustrates other than direct response can work. I had a client last year who signed up, and for various reasons, like it wasn't ever going to be a long-term thing for us to work together. But when he signed up, he goes, wow, I mean, boy, you really email a lot. And the reality at the time, I wasn't even emailing every day, which I am now. But at the time, it was just like an email sequence that he was getting that was like sort of the welcome stuff. Like, here's how I can help you. Here are some things that I observe, sort of my big ideas, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, did that bother you? He's like, well, gosh, I don't want to get an email. I think at the time it was like every other day for like 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay.
But he bought from me. He spent thousands of dollars on my coaching.
Right.
And maybe this is the double-edged sword of direct response. I hit at the problem that he was having, and therefore he knew to call me when it was time, or in this case, fill out a form when it was time to work together. But he also wasn't a perfect fit. And even though he didn't love the tactic, it still worked. And it's worth emphasizing, he wasn't a perfect fit.
Yeah.
So maybe that was my failing in the sales process. I could have disqualified him sooner or seen some red flags sooner. But I do think it's interesting that even though some people may be maybe not turned off, but not totally comfortable with all of the tactics, they can still bring people in who you can actually help.
Right. That's why I feel like it's so critical that you think about where your business is in its maturity or its growth from a little embryo to something more mature.
Yep.
We lived at the Oregon coast for about 2 years, my wife and I, and we had this neighbor who was really into guns.
Uh-huh.
And one time I was out, I don't know, working in the yard or whatever, and he was trying to start a fire, I think so he could burn some garbage in a 55-gallon drum.
Perfect.
And apparently that doesn't work well unless you've got some air holes in the bottom of the drum. And
not a physics major.
And he realized this. So he needed some holes in the bottom of the drum.
Okay.
What did he do? I would have gotten a drill. He just got out one of his guns and shot some holes through it.
Shot holes into the barrel.
Yep. That's exactly what he did.
God, that sounds fun, actually.
To me, that's just like a funny story about how you use tools and what tools you choose to use for the job, right? And in this case, your usage of direct response tools brought you a client, which maybe you really needed that client at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's part of why you said yes, even though the fit wasn't great. I think about this thing that has become known as the magic email, which is an email that you would send to someone who's kind of gone dark on you. And to me, it's full of the stuff about direct response that makes me a little bit uncomfortable. Can you recite the email for us, Liston? You probably know it by heart.
I don't.
I don't either.
Actually, I was new to the magic email party train, but I'm on the website and it says, since I've not heard from you on this, I have to assume your priorities have changed.
Right. I used that once or twice, and one time it worked, and it got me the worst client I've ever had. The guy didn't take the project seriously. He didn't prioritize it. Apparently, I sort of guilted him into doing it.
Yeah.
Through the usage of this magic email. And that's why I say the tool is neutral. It's how you use it. And there's certain tools that I just, maybe it's because I'm not sophisticated or savvy enough that I kind of start shying away from.
Mm-hmm.
Artificial scarcity. Have we talked about that yet? That's on our list.
It is. So let me give one example. So I think a lot of consultants or kind of coaches and that kind of group, people like us, Philip, the way they would use this is they would say something under the contact, like if you had like a contact me now or schedule a call or something like that, you would include a statement that said something like, I'm usually fully booked, but I may have a few openings this week.
Right.
First come, first serve.
Right.
Something like that would be creating oftentimes an artificial sense of scarcity. And the reason I say oftentimes is because if you really are booked, you're not going to let people book you from your website. I think that's generally the case. So yeah, that would be an obvious demonstration of it. Again, I'm really curious if you're listening to this right now and you're disagreeing with everything we're saying about people having negative responses to this direct response, please do tell us.
You got to get us out of our heads on this one.
Totally. I do sense, though, that, Philip, if you were interested in a consulting gig with a $100 million firm that's looking to like do a monumental positioning project and they want you to be a key advisor to that project, my guess is they wouldn't like to see that on the website.
That's my guess as well.
Let's investigate that. I know this episode is going long here, but I think this is a really interesting discussion and also a tough topic. I think it does come down to people like us do things like this. If it's an Accenture, they're going to want your website to look like their website.
Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah.
And I think it really is as simple as that. I don't know that it's because they would necessarily see you as desperate or that would be consciously on their mind, but they would see you as, he's not the same as us.
Yeah. I mean, the first place I came across this idea in a way that really stuck with me was you had recommended a perennial seller, Ryan Holiday's book, in which he quotes probably Seth Godin saying, anything that doesn't fit within a genre is automatically way harder to sell. That's not a direct quote from Seth Godin, but that's the idea of it.
Right.
If it doesn't fit a genre, you've like multiplied the difficulty of, I mean, frankly, of selling it, but even beyond that, just of like getting awareness for it. And I think there's maybe a genre of like, this is so weird, it doesn't fit any genre, like maybe Google Glass. No, Google Glass was a total sci-fi genre, sci-fi made real. That's a genre of tech products you occasionally see things in. So even that had a genre
Right. But just to that point, though, Google Glass was not considered in the cell phone genre, and therefore it's not for me. That's most people are like, oh, that's a weird toy.
Yeah, right. It seems to be finding a home in like the augmented reality, like weird stuff that scientists and technicians might use on the job.
Right.
A specialized tool, in other words. Back to the point. You show up at a meeting for CEOs and they're all wearing suits and you're not. You don't fit the genre. And it's as simple as that. Like, I think that's really what you're saying is like, my website doesn't look like Accenture's. So there's plenty of clients who are going to just dismiss me out of hand without a second thought. The first thought is, this is a different genre. It's not the genre we're looking for. I don't think it goes beyond that. I think you're right, Liston. In other words, I don't think they're saying, let me really think about at a very detailed and nuanced level, this person's usage of brand marketing versus direct response. No, it doesn't ever go that far. It goes as far as, doesn't look like Accenture's website. Next, moving right along.
Yeah.
Like that's about how much time you have when it's a question of genre. And again, that's why with the positioning manual, the genre I want to be in, maybe I'll regret this. I can always change my mind. It's a self-published book. It's not hard to do. But the genre I want to be in is business book, like serious business book, like Blue Ocean Strategy, Million Dollar Consulting. There's lots of titles where they define a part of a genre that I would like to be a part of.
Yeah. And so maybe it ultimately is as simple as that. Maybe it's just like...
Oh, like we could think of direct response as a genre and then brand marketing as a different genre. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'd even go simpler than that. Maybe it's as simple as like you need to look like the clients that you want to have.
Or alternately, look like the peers you want to have. If you're thinking about like, okay, I'm on the supply side here. What are the peers that I want to be like already doing?
Right. Would I be seen as part of this category if I did things X, Y, and Z?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a totally valid takeaway for folks is to say, who are your competitors or the competitors that you aspire to be a member of? And like, you want to be the next Ramit Sethi? Well, I think it's totally fair to use his very direct response heavy style.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be the next, who should we pick?
Simon Sinek is one that I've been using a lot lately.
Yeah. Want to be the next Simon Sinek? Okay. Well, maybe look at what he's doing and do your best imitation of that. Not that you shouldn't be differentiated. That's a different thing.
Well, right. And I think what we're saying is the appearance of your marketing needs to be similar. Tactically, it doesn't need to be all the same. But if he's not trying to tease you with a lead magnet and sort of entice you to have a call on every single page, that may be something that you want to consider not doing either if you want to be in his company.
Exactly.
Well, I think we've done it.
We've certainly used all the time that we have.
We have. I think we're probably going to have to revisit this at some point as our opinions on it evolve.
For sure.
This was good, Philip. It was clarifying for me, at least. I don't know if anybody listening to this got something out of it, but I enjoyed it.
I hope the folks at home got something from it. If nothing else, just some food for thought or maybe a new lens to look at things. When you're looking at how people that you aspire to be like do marketing, maybe you'll start to notice some details that you haven't noticed or some nuance you haven't noticed. There's no right or wrong anything. I think I would say that I think Seth Godin really nailed it when he's like, if you don't fit into a genre, you really need to think about that because you may be signing up for something that's way more difficult than it needs to be. With some tweaks, you might fit better into a genre that helps you and helps you help the people you want to help.
Indeed.